Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Is the Savage Nation. Welcome to the program. Welcome to the Bookmobile. Did the video tour, 11, 12 cities in 3 hours with Teddy today. And the number one question that kept coming up is, what do you think is going to happen in about a month from now? What do you think is going to happen? Are the Democrats really going to lose that many seats? What's amazing to me is that every TV show I did asked almost the same question. And yesterday, the Gallup poll delivered its first 2010 likely voter poll. And the results were so shocking that the entire political world is reeling from it. They say that in its high turnout voter model, Republicans are leading Democrats by 53% to 40%. And if it's a low turnout this year, the GOP edge was a stunning 56% to 38%. Michael Barone says that the historical parallel may be the year 1894, when Republicans gained more than 100 House seats in the middle of the economic downturn that engulfed Democratic President Grover Cleveland. Now, what I cautioned many of the hosts was, so what? What, we're going to have Bush's team back again? Isn't that wonderful? The people who gave us a $1 trillion deficit? The people who gave us two wars? I mean, what are we going to do if we have that? So the answer is not, let's rush to Republicans, but let's rush to the independents. Let's rush to the Tea Party candidates. Let's show Washington that we the people own this country, not the special interests. And another thing kept coming up. They kept saying to me, well, what's your main point? You know, and since this tour was in smaller cities, you know, 3 hours, one studio, one city after another, and I'll give you some of the details later, I decided to keep it very simple. I focused on the economy, and I started like this. Tell me what you think of this. I said, do you know that President Obama has increased the national debt by more than the debt incurred by all presidents from George Washington to Ronald Reagan? The hosts were floored by that. And then they say, well, Michael Savage, what's the solution? I said, well, in trickle-up poverty, I offer 37 solutions. And one of them is to impose tariffs on Chinese goods. And I said, this was once the greatest manufacturing nation on earth. I said, there's no reason we can't be making steel here and ball bearings here and hammers here and machine tools here, and sneakers here, and balls here. I said, there's no reason we can't do that. I said, I'd like to see the manufacturing base restored to this country. And there's only one way to do that, and that's put a tariff on Chinese goods. And they say, well, wouldn't that start a trade war? I said, my friend, you don't think we're in a trade war? I said, we're in a trade war. What do you think China's doing to us right now? They're paying $1 to $3 an hour. We're paying our workers $15 to $50 an hour. That's not an even playing field. We're in a trade war. You have an even playing field is when the wages are the same in one country to another. I said, the only way to get this manufacturing alive again in America is putting in tariffs on Chinese goods. Then they asked me about the war in Afghanistan. And I said, what? The war in Afghanistan? I said, end it. Bring the boys home now. Some have done 4, 5, 6 tours. They don't know what they're doing there. The Defense Department won't even name the enemy. They're sitting there like cannon fodder waiting to be shot at before they can fire back. The rules of engagement have to be changed. It's all in my book, Trickle Up Poverty. So I had a pretty good day today. You know, 11, 12 cities in a couple of hours. And, you know, Wichita, Rochester, Pittsburgh, Fort Myers, Detroit, Tucson, San Diego, Cincinnati, Las Vegas, and Phoenix. And it was quite an experience, I got to tell you. It felt as though I was being strapped into a cyclotron each time I went up for the next go-around, because it does spin your head a bit. In only one city did they say to me, what about Teddy? Is he with you? Teddy wouldn't let me leave the house this morning. I was leaving. I was getting in the car. The car was there in the driveway. They were about to leave. He started to whine, cry, beg upstairs on the deck. I said, okay, damn. I went and got him, brought him along, dark morning, got him in the studio. He behaved so beautifully. I didn't put him on the air. He was my mascot. Every time the sound man went to put the little earplug in my ear or went to adjust it, Teddy snapped his hands or his feet. It was very cute. My attack poodle. One city, though, they opened by playing rock and roll in San Diego on XETV in San Diego because they love my show. And they said, is Teddy there with you? I said, yes. And guess what? Teddy did make a brief appearance in San Diego. Incidentally, TUP is number one in conservative books right now. It is number one in conservative books on Amazon. I want to thank you very much. But I want to ask you a question today. Have you gone to a bookstore today to buy this book? Was the book displayed? Was it in the upfront place where it's supposed to be? What was the worst thing that happened to you when you tried to buy the book? Was the clerk friendly or belligerent? Did they bury the book? And what happened when you went to pay for trickle-up poverty? Did the green-haired, double-nose-ring clerk say anything to you? What kind of people were buying trickle-up poverty? And I want you to call in if you have a favorite section today. Let's begin in Kansas City. Brad, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
Savage, I went over my lunch break today to our local chain bookstore, and I purchased the very last copy that they had.
The last copy? They sold out already?
They sold out at one of the stores here in Kansas City. Now I'm on my way home. Going to eat dinner with the family, and then I'm going to lock myself in the man cave, and I'm going to read it all tonight.
Let me ask you something. Was it at Barnes & Noble or Borders or one of those chains?
Yes, at Barnes & Noble.
That's beautiful, because we're in every store in America, every chain store, Barnes & Noble, Borders Books, Books A Million. I can name the chains. I'm going to get the names before I say something that isn't true. But the publisher paid for upfront placement. Was the book at the front of the counter, or was it buried?
It was at the very right inside the front door.
Oh, on a stack. You know, I'm so trepidatious to go into a bookstore after my experiences. I may go down to my local Barnes & Noble tonight with a disguise. I don't know what the disguise is going to be. I may actually go there and take a picture of myself next to a stack of the book. This is amazing. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number, michaelsavage.com. As I said, I did 11 cities today in a couple of hours, came home, took a nap, and here we are. Teddy's knocked out. I hear that Jimmy Carter did a book tour. He went to do 11 cities, but he canceled after the first four cities because they ran out of snakes on the plane. I heard that Sean Hannity was going to do a book tour, but he ran out after five cities because they ran out of hammers. Somebody told me that the golfer was on a golf tour, but he had to cancel after only four holes because he ran out of balls. There's another story here that I got to share with you. Nancy Pelosi did a book tour, but she canceled after only one city. She ran out of cannoli. Barbara Boxer, I understand, is in the fight for her life, so she wrote a book or ghosted a book or something, and they canceled her after five cities because they ran out of bagels. And finally, we hear on the inside line here that Larry King was on a book tour, but he canceled after only two cities. His seltzer ran flat. What's wrong with a little, a stand-up shtick here? It's gentle. I don't have to use F words or dirty words to get your attention, do I? This is serious business. We're in the fight for our life here, and I think we're going to be hoodwinked, frankly. The problem is that we're giddy. We all sense that the Dems are going to be thrown out. We're going to send the message to the Democrats that we really can't stand them. We're not ready for socialism and that liberalism is dead. The problem is, if we get the K Street gang back, those who worked for Bush, meaning the congressmen who were doing this to us before Obama came along, tell me the gain in that. The problem is going to be the same, and that's our problem. We have to hold their feet to the fire, so to speak. We've got to give them a litmus test. And my friends, I'm telling you, if you quiz them, if you're going to get anywhere near them during the town hall meetings, ask them where they stand on illegal immigration. Ask them where they stand on our economy. Ask them where they stand on security. Ask them if they're willing to actually fight to repeal Obamacare. And finally, well, I'll tell you more about it when I come back here on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. Study them hard and hoping to pass. Work
and your fingers. Savage's Manifesto for Saving America. Thank God for Matt Drudge. That's all I could say. It's invisible in the media other than for WorldNet Daily and the Drudge Report. I may as well not exist. But with this radio show, people said to me today, the TV people, like, what do you hope to do with this book? They said, do you hope to change the election? I said, I better change the election. I said, yeah, I better change the election. I said, if people will take this book, if they will take it to work, if they will take it even to a supermarket line, if they're shy and say nothing, the cover speaks for them. It's written, yeah, okay, it's got 110,000 words, so it's got a lot of detail, 30 pages of references or so. But the cover was designed as a billboard, a single billboard for each person holding it. You know, they say one picture is worth 1,000 words. Trickle up poverty, stopping Obama's attack on our borders, economy, and security. It says an awful lot, and that's why I did the book, okay? Las Vegas, Michael, you're on the Savage Nation. What did you experience today?
Well, I tried to go online, and I saw that your book was available on Borders, and I didn't want to wait for it to be delivered because I want to read it on a flight I'm taking soon. I call them. The advertised price is $26.99 or around there, and then the price that is available online is about half that. I asked the lady very nicely if I could come in and pay the online half price, advertised price, and first you want to know, well, what is the book? So I explained it, and I got one of those, oh, hold on. She held me on for over 3 minutes. I was assuming she just thought I was going to hang up and give up on it, but I wasn't going to do that. And then when she came back, she said, nope, it is what it is. If you want it for that price, you got to order it online. So
what if you had asked her if you bought that, if you took a book like Johnny Has Two Daddies, would they have been nicer to you, think, in that bookstore?
Either that or John Leibowitz. I'm sure one of those books she would have been more than happy to deliver.
Well, what are you going to do? Michael, I'm going to send you a free copy of TUP today. Stay on the line. 1-800-449-8255. What about New York? What's going on in New York? Is it allowed in New York? Does Bloomberg permit the book to cross the Hudson River? I want to know. Ray on WOR, have you seen TUP today in the bookstores?
Good afternoon, Michael. How are you? My experience today, I went to go buy your book, and I walked into Penn Books in the Long Island Railroad concourse at Penn Station. When I asked for the book, they pretended like they had never heard of you before. And then I pressed them a little further, and the gentleman certainly knew who it was and where it was. It was on the bottom rack, at which point he took it out and put it on the table and asked me if I wanted a bag for it. I proudly said, absolutely not. Paid my cash and walked out the door.
And well, maybe we should provide plain brown wrappers for it, since it's considered such an offense to the Democrats in America. I mean, liberals are not. Hey, let me tell you something. Liberals are probably going to react quite strongly to this book cover. I can guarantee you, if you carry this on the Long Island Railroad or a subway, you're going to get some eye turning. If you want to really upset the apple cart, this cover doesn't mince words. Thank you very much for buying it. Well, it's already beat the Leprechaun. It's number one in conservative books on Amazon. And I know that the Leprechaun can't be too happy with that. And that makes me, that makes my day. I mean, what can I tell you? The gang at Fox News won't have me on. It's sort of like a little, what do you want me to say about it? You got a so-called conservative network. You got a best-selling author writing a blockbuster conservative book. And nobody's allowed to have me on because the Leprechaun says so? That seems to be sort of censorship. I thought that the conservatives were into, like, fair and balanced, and let's discuss it and let's debate it. Well, I guess there's certain things that they are afraid of debating, and there are certain books that they don't want to hear about, but perhaps if a hooker or a pimp comes along, they can certainly put them up on one of the shows. That might help ratings. So there's no bitterness. I can do without them. They can do without me. But it's pretty much a pretty big story when you see that Fox News won't have Michael Savage on. After all, I wasn't born yesterday. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. San Diego Pascal, welcome to the Savage Nation. Your experience, please.
5:30 this morning, I walked into the JFK terminal for JetBlue, and there was a Barnes & Noble there. I looked everywhere for it. It was not to be found.
In the JFK terminal, the Barnes & Noble kiosk, is it a store or kiosk?
It was actually a storefront, like, you know, where it was in the terminal for JetBlue.
And that's a Barnes & Noble. Then I'm sending you a free copy. We'll report that to the publisher. I don't know why it isn't there. Stay on the line. I appreciate that very much. Now we have something interesting now. Jeffrey in Florida. welcome to the Savage Nation. What is it you want to say?
Yeah, Dr. Savage, I'm reading page 25 of Revolution is Brewing, where you compare Dale Roberson to the elite Republican establishment types. And so far in the book, that's my favorite part.
Hold on. Wait. 25? Who's Dale?
Dale Roberson. He's one of the organizers.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I got it. We've seen what the Counterfeit Tea Party plan has to offer. Now, who am I referring to when I refer to the Counterfeit Tea Party? Who are they?
Well, the Counterfeit Tea Party would be the Republican leadership trying to co-opt.
Yes, the Dick Army, in my opinion, and I said this before anybody else, the Republican Party set up a fake Tea Party, which has no teeth in it. The platform is filled with liberal platitudes. It's very much Bush all over again. And this fake Tea Party was set up to co-opt the real Tea Party movement, Jeffrey.
Oh, absolutely. And if I may add, Doctor, the last book of yours that I read cover to cover was The Savage Nation. And I must say, this one is much more scholarly oriented. It's a much, much better presentation. As much as I like The Savage Nation, I really like the way you've
Of all of the books that I have written that you have read, how would you rate this or rank it?
Right at the top. I've read one of your books, Natural Healing, and I've read The Savage Nation, but this one is amazing. This is very well presented.
I believe this book is the best book I've ever written. I believe it's going to be my last nonfiction book in terms of politics. I don't think I'm ever going to write another one. It took too much out of me. The book tour is too difficult. The promotion is too difficult. Frankly, it's written with one intent, which is to make certain that the Democrats are thrown out in November and that Barack Obama loses in the year 2012, no matter who the Republicans run. It's a very interesting theory that one book can change the course of human events, and I hope that this is true. But I didn't write this book for a quick one-month season. I wrote it for, let us say, a two-year cycle. Thank you very much for calling, Jeffrey, in Florida. Illegal aliens are illegal. Stronger military is essential. Gun ownership is sacred. Deficit spending will end. English only is required. And yes, we are a Christian nation. Does that work for you?
Savage.
Boom, boom, boom.
So here's a funny question. How is it that in my own hometown of San Francisco, not one television show, not one radio show, so far as I know, not one bookstore is carrying the book? I'm an icon in the Bay Area. I'm the only person in the San Francisco area who ever went national and did anything with himself, and they hate me for it. This is a town filled with rubes and filled with false prophets and fake poets. And the fact is that I can't find the book anywhere. So my friend Jack writes, he said, well, I'll tell you what, you want to come into town this week in disguise, and I will go into the liberal bookstore in North Beach and have someone video us. Hey, that's an idea, he says. Have me go to all the local bookstores asking for your book while the video guy is shooting it, with you in disguise like Hitchcock, maybe dressed as a rabbi in a beard or maybe as an imam. Jack has a very filmic sense, Jack. That might be a kick. He wants me to do this movie, you know, like a comedic movie. Anyway, this is a heady time for me because, you know, you put a book out, you work on it, it comes out, and then comes the tour. I'm calling this Hell Week, and this is day one. This is day one of Hell Week. 3 o'clock in the morning is not for me, but I was up at 3:15. You ever do this when you have like a flight in the morning? I'm sure you do. The eye sees the digital readout, 3:18. You go back to sleep, you look, it's 3:33. You think you're going to get in another hour or two before you wake up. It's 3:49. So then you're up already, your mind is spinning. You can't go back to sleep. You have a choice. You can force yourself back, then you're going to be groggy. So you throw it in and you get up at 4 in the morning when you don't have to leave till 6. You got 2 horrible hours in the dark. You don't know what to do with yourself. So you do emails, and then there's no one up at that hour. Nowhere in the world can you reach anybody for some reason. The dog wouldn't get out of bed, but as I say, he came with me. It was fabulous. 1-800-449-8255. What's your experience been? Is it there? Did Barnes & Noble have it? Did Borders have it? Did Books A Million have it? Is it up front as it's supposed to be? Did you get a snide comment? Did you get support? I was treated very well today because these are good American cities. But remember, the cities I was on today on the video tour were smaller cities where the, let's put it to you this way, nicer people tend to reside. I wasn't really on in the porn belt, okay? The porn belt, I would expect, you know, nastiness. But you know what? I'm able to handle it, trust me, and I'm not looking forward to it. And I don't think I want to go on any shows where it's antagonistic. I'd rather discuss the ideas and have them debated. You know, I understand this is like a thesis. What is a book really if it's really a book? You're making an assertion. My assertion is that Obama's destroying America, that the Democrats are destroying America. They've led us into socialism. They're destroying the military. They've melted down the borders. They've wrecked the economy. That's my assertion. So now, how do I begin? I begin in every city the same way I begin with you. Keep it simple, stupid. Keep it simple, stupid. Let's talk about the economy. This is a shocking fact. I don't think there's a liberal listening to this show who can refute this fact, because it's a fact from the government itself. What is the fact? It's a horrible fact. Obama has run up the deficit to a greater extent than all presidents combined, from George Washington to Ronald Reagan. That's an amazing statement. And who is going to pay for this? And I think that if people start to realize that we have a fiscally insane administration, then they're going to ask themselves, well, will the Republicans be any different? Remember, there was only one person on the conservative side who was ridiculing George Bush and seeing what he was doing, and it was me. And it was 2 years into his administration where I started to see what he was doing, and I called Bush a fiscal socialist, if you recall. And it kept getting worse. He was building the government, building the government, building the government, spending money like it was water, putting money into foreign aid, more war, more deficit spending. It was not fiscal conservatism. And many people I have met in my life are not social conservatives, but they're smart enough to know that we need a fiscal conservative in the White House. So they figured, you know what? We don't even have that with Bush. We didn't have a social conservative that I know of. He left the borders wide open. But I'm not here to bash Bush. I'm here to tell you that the problem was inherited by Obama, but he made it 3 to 5 times worse. Moreover, we have to talk about style. Do you remember Nancy Pelosi's arrogance when she jammed Obamacare down your throat? Do you remember that woman's arrogance when she walked around with that big hammer and she boasted that I have a hammer, I hammer in the morning, I hammer in the evening, I hammer all day, and the media just lapped it up like the lapdogs that they are? Did you find that appealing to see a woman talk like that about forcing such an unpopular socialist plan down our throats? The woman alienated 90% of Americans. And that's why there's a backlash against Obama. It was Nancy Pelosi more than it was Obama, because he's not an arrogant man, incidentally. His presentation is much more measured. She was out of control, and she was drunk with her power. And that walk with that big hammer, in my opinion, if you ask me what the turning point was, that was it. It was that hammer, and it was that walk after Obamacare. That's what did it. That's what turned the corner. Now, having said all of that, I want to read you something, if you don't mind. I want to read something. One of the hosts today said to me, isn't Obama really just spreading the wealth around a little bit and giving the poor something they didn't have? I said, nothing could be further from the truth. He's actually attacking the middle class. And that is because he spent his entire life around left-wingers, Marxists, socialists of every stripe, for whom the bourgeoisie was the enemy. Don't you remember the 60s, if you're old enough to remember the rhetoric of the 60s? The bourgeoisie was the enemy, as you sat around smoking dope, waiting for the chance to buy yourself a new Mercedes and live in a beautiful home over Pacific Palisades, the day you could enter the bourgeoisie. But you sat there and you put down the bourgeoisie as though your parents were gauche, the middle class was not your goal, you didn't want a house with a picket fence. Well, what did you want? How did you want to live? And so, as I say, it's an attitude. The attitude is the middle class is the enemy. Remember, how was America defined for so many years? I remember my mother would say to me that America is the greatest country because it has the largest middle class. I didn't know what that meant as a kid. Well, what it meant was, she explained it to me. She said in Europe, there's basically two classes. And it was at that time more true than today, because they've become a little more capitalist, as we become a little more socialist, unfortunately. But they were the rich and the poor. And she said, in America, you could do very well as a middle-class person. And so I understood what the middle class was. Well, the middle class is shrinking under Obama. More houses in default, more jobs lost. But this is not by accident. He is aiming it at the middle class. Obama's confiscating his taxes. the socialist takeover of the healthcare system and other legislative initiatives which he has in mind are taking away our earnings and our power to choose how we live our lives, and he is putting it in the hands of corrupt and pro-socialist cohorts. Now, let me tell you something else that I really have to share with you. When I'm on this radio show, I kind of, it's a no-holds-barred. I speak exactly my mind. I don't know, it's almost a product in a certain way of foolishness, to be frank with you. I got to tell you that. Because I speak with you somehow too honestly. I tell you what I actually think. You know it's gotten me in trouble. I've made some real bad enemies, mainly the wonderful Brits who banned me from entering their country, linking me up with murderers and terrorists with no help from the ACLU or any of the other so-called First Amendment types here in America. No help whatsoever. But why is it that when I'm on the radio, I speak to you as though no one hears us, as though it's a private conversation? I speak to you as though I'm on the telephone with you, and so I tell you how I see it. Then get in the car, put on the suit, put on the tie, go on TV. Lights on, action on. All of a sudden, I realize that I really shouldn't say everything that I say on the radio on television. It seems to be a different medium. It doesn't permit you to become as intimately truthful as the radio. And I really realized that today for the first time. Some of the things that are in my book that the host read back to me almost sounded shocking to me. Would you believe it? It didn't mean that they didn't make sense or I didn't write it because I believed it. It almost seems shocking. Chapter 10, Obama's War on the Military and on National Security. I mean, it's pretty amazing stuff in this book. And I got to tell you, it's not going to make an awful lot of powerful people happy. So let me begin with A Revolution is Brewing in Chapter 1 because it's filled with personal stories. Actually, you know what? I really want to go to the Wall Street chapter because I want to tell you about my bank account when I was a kid, if I could find that. It's almost one of my favorite stories that you never heard. I don't want to talk about healthcare here. Nightmare on Wall Street. It's a cute story. Here it goes. Can I start with this? Chapter 4, page 79. When I was 11 years old, I had my first bank account at Bankers Trust Company on Union Turnpike in Queens, New York. Each week, I would deposit the money I earned from the local candy store, where I worked after school as a soda jerk. I felt like the richest kid on the planet when the account grew to something like $618.08 after 1 year. One night, while reviewing my account, I discovered something startling. I looked at the balance and discovered that while I had only deposited $600, there was $18 more than I'd actually put in. I went to my father and, holding my savings summary for him to see, I said, "Hey, Dad, the bank made a mistake. They deposited more money than I put in. Should I return it to them?" He said, "Michael, that's your interest." I said, "Dad, what's interest?" He said, "Well, they take your money and they invest it, and then they give you back a little bit of what they make on their investment. That's called interest, and you get to keep it." That was the day I became a capitalist. That's the day when I first understood the value of saving and investing. Over the years, I grew in my understanding of building wealth through savings and investments, as well as the risks and rewards associated with placing funds in the stock market. I imagine you may have had a similar experience when you were young. And if you, like many in the middle class, you probably opened an individual retirement account or employer-based 401k retirement savings plan, maybe in addition to modest investments in the stock market. While you and I played by the rules and trusted Wall Street with our monies, others behind the scenes manipulated America's leading financial institutions for their own personal gain. That gain wasn't just measured in lining their pockets. In some instances, as you'll see in a moment, it was to advance an agenda. Case in point, page 80. In 2007, Christopher Cox, then chairman of the SEC, under pressure from lobbyists, did not prevent the change of two regulations that allowed hedge fund pirates to plunder the U.S. financial markets. This change in policy was responsible for driving down the value of America's assets by more than $10 trillion in 2008. Let's be clear. There was an agenda lurking behind the shadowy dealings. Is it a coincidence that this happened right before the presidential election? Hardly. Where did those dollars go? I'm going to continue on page 80 of Trickle Up Poverty when I return right here in the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Don't know much about
history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book.
Well, here's some news on the top of Drudge. Obama-Clinton ticket on the table. Do you actually think that making Hillary Clinton the vice presidential candidate is going to change? It's like switching, you know, deck chairs on a sinking Titanic. She's not that popular. I don't know what they're thinking. What, she's going to get the woman vote? And what's the vice president's name? I don't even remember. Agnew? What's his name? Oh, Biden. Over Biden. So Biden could run an international water gun contest around the world. He could sort of become the Mitt Romney of the water gun Olympics if he leaves the vice presidency. Are you serious? The Obama-Clinton ticket is the best they can come up with? Why don't they start from the top and put an X through both names, because that's about the only chance they have. If they don't run a fiscally conservative, socially conservative Democrat, and they do exist, by the way, the party is going to go into default. They have wrecked the party. Obama and his left-wing radical policies have wrecked the Democrat Party virtually for the next 20 years. I believe that to be true. Now, let me go back to my chapter. Nightmare on Wall Street. I told you about my first bank account, Bankers Trust. I can still remember the book to this day, right? And I earned interest, and I became a capitalist. Then I told you about Christopher Cox, then chairman of the SEC, under pressure from lobbyists, did not prevent the change of two regulations that allowed hedge fund pirates to plunder the U.S. financial markets. And I said, where did $10 trillion go in 2008? Here we go. Page 80, trickle-up poverty. They ended up in the hands of a relatively small number of people and companies whose purpose was far more nefarious than merely making profits. The raiders who trashed our markets sought nothing less than to use the control they had gained over our financial system to put a wet-behind-the-ears leftist president in office. Moreover, they leveraged that power to create a government run on socialist principles, but controlled by a small group of wealthy investors who dictate policy to the puppet president they elected. In effect, they pushed us further along the path to a socialist oligarchy. Another player in the financial meltdown is the leftist financier George Soros, who some believe has been trying for decades to manipulate American politics to the advantage of the Marxists with whom he is in league. It seems to me that Soros tried to rig the 2004 presidential election in favor of John Kerry. How? By pouring tens of millions of dollars into Kerry's campaign coffers and into building anti-capitalist, anti-democratic organizations such as MoveOn.org. In spite of that massive investment, Soros was unsuccessful. Did he give up? Far from it, page 81. During the next few years, the Managed Funds Association, MFA, a group of hedge fund investors with whom Soros is affiliated, lobbied SEC Chairman Cox to have the rules changed. Why? So they could engineer a raid on U.S. markets to trigger a financial crisis that they foresaw could turn the election in favor of their 08 candidate, Barack Hussein Obama. This time the strategy worked. In the end, some believe that George Soros and similarly minded financiers benefited in an extraordinary way while moving the country dangerously toward control by leftists. Despite this alleged manipulation of the marketplace, Soros is free and active today. While he's still denying his involvement in one of the greatest scandals in American history, that is, when he's not crowing that he had a very good crisis, I'm wondering why there isn't an investigation into this matter. Hundreds upon hundreds of minor players were involved in this fraud as well. Another member of the MFA is John Paulson, no relation to former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, one of the architects of the TARP bailout. Paulson saw the value of his hedge fund firm rise exponentially in 07, thanks to the rule changes that the MFA lobbied for. While he predicted the crash and the demise of Lehman Brothers and Wachovia, the real reasons he was able to realize huge profits from the financial meltdown were the rule changes that he took advantage of to line his pockets. Paulson, like Cox and Soros, is still plying his trade, in his case as a hedge fund trader. He's still enjoying the billions of dollars in profits he made personally from participating in the attack on the American economy. Reference number 4. Now, I got to say something right here. Every one of these statements is backed up with a reference. It's not going to make a lot of people happy. A lot of them are going to deny everything in this book. First, they're going to ignore it. Then they're going to deny it. And then they're going to attack it as sure as I'm sitting here. The fact is the American people deserve an answer. Where did the $10 trillion go that disappeared in 2008. Make no mistake about it, some people profited tremendously. And I think that you deserve an answer. So there it is. There's a lot more, by the way. You say the two rules. What are the two rules? What do we need to stop these gangsters from operating on Wall Street? When I say these gangsters, I mean the people who are still getting away with murder. The fact of the matter is I spell it out. It's called the Uptick Rule and the Glass-Steagall Act. Remember, there was a depression in 1929. Remember the stock market crash? It was very similar to what we're living through right now. At that time, I remember in high school, I had very smart teachers in Jamaica High School in New York. They taught me that there was a depression. They taught us why it happened. It was plain and simple because it was called speculation. People were allowed to buy stocks on margin. I didn't know what that meant, but my teacher explained it to me. They could buy a stock in a company for nothing down. Nothing down. Why? Mr. and Mrs. America bought lots of stocks for nothing down, and they thought they were getting rich. Or let's say for a few dollars down. It couldn't be nothing down, a few dollars down, because you had to get some of the suckers into the Ponzi scheme. Well, that was one of the things that was changed after the Great Depression. You had to have a minimal amount of money to put in to buy a stock. Same with houses, I've told you before. When I went to buy my first house in 1974, the bank said you had to have 20% down. I said, I have only 15%. They said, come back when you have 20. Now take a look at what went on here. They were selling houses to people and giving them money to take that house. They were giving them a minus 10% mortgage. Many illegal aliens benefited from this. Many people who were not qualified benefited from it. So isn't it inevitable that there would have been a housing crash? It was created. The bubble was created. But not everybody lost. Okay?
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Wonder who wrote the book of love? Tell me, who wrote the book of love? I've got to know the answer. Was it someone from above?
It is the Savage Nation, and it's all a dream. I think really life is a dream, to be honest with you. At a certain point, when you get tired, you start to ask yourself, A, where the time go, where the years go, what's real, what are you driving yourself, what makes Sammy run? You've had one bestseller after another, what'd you need another book for, why'd you write it? And I was asked this by a very important media person about 9 months ago. He said, you know, you don't need the money, but why are you writing the book? I said, I need one major league book, one book that changes the course of human events. We've got to stop the Democrats before it's too late. And truthfully, people who know me know that that's true. It's as simple as that. And I don't really want to, you know, go on and on about it and make some noble experiment out of this. The fact is, it's a very important book at a very critical time. And right now, I want to thank everyone listening to the show who's gone to a bookstore or gone on Amazon, because it's now number one amongst conservative books. It is still only number 15 overall. I hope to make that number one over the next few days, okay? I have only a few friends in the media. Joe Farah of World Net Daily is one of them. Matt Drudge is another. And let me tell you something. Without them, the book would be invisible other than this show and a few radio shows that I'm going to do tomorrow. And so I have to thank them profusely. 1-800-449-8255. But most of all, wait a minute. Most of all, I wanted to say this. I hold it. Let me back up a minute. When I was doing the video tour this morning, sitting there in the studio, the lights, the blah, blah, blah. I don't like television. It's a very tough medium for me. Some thrive on it. I don't. I don't know how you could fall in love and get teary-eyed with a light in your eye. But, you know, you're sitting there and you're talking to people in Pittsburgh and they know your show. Or you're talking to a host in Detroit or Cincinnati or Las Vegas and they know your show. It's all because of this radio show. And I got to thank my syndicator. I got to thank my production staff. I really have to thank God himself because there were times that I was, let us say, without all of these attributes. Radio is still the most miraculous of all mediums. It's still a miracle. I'm not one of those who's down on radio and says it's going away tomorrow. In fact, I think radio is going to have a renaissance because it's the last of the mediums that permit you to connect with the audience in this way. You can't do it on the internet. You can't do it on television. There's only one medium where people have a feeling that you know them and they know you, and that's radio. I even said that to you earlier in the other hour. I said I noticed something while I was on the television tour this morning. I felt as though I was speaking in public and that I had to be a little more careful in what I was saying. I don't understand it, though. Here I am back in the radio studio, and I don't have that same feeling. I have the feeling that I'm speaking to you in a private conversation. So I'm telling you what I actually see and what I actually think needs to be done to get us off this disastrous course that President Obama has taken us on. He's not inherently a bad man. He is a product of his environment. He is a product of decades of left-wing propaganda put into his head, as I point out in the book. It doesn't make him evil. It just makes him wrong. It makes him a bad captain. And we got to stop this captain before he takes us down a river that we can't come back from. And so I want to say to you again on the Savage Nation, whether you buy the book or you don't buy the book, story, it's from chapter 1 of TUP. Here it is. Many years ago, while I was in graduate school in Hawaii, a near-death boating experience on the high seas taught me a life lesson that directly relates to the problems we're having with President Obama. Do you know what it's like for a kid from New York City to wind up in Hawaii? I'd never been to a place as remarkable as Hawaii. It was like walking into heaven itself. When you land in heaven, you think you can do anything. Almost overnight, you have hubris. Hubris is a sense of excessive self-confidence that only children and the mad should have. But when a grown-up has hubris, it becomes very dangerous. And in my case, that was true. So I get to the islands, and it's a magical time. I never saw sunsets like this. They can break your heart. And the flowers, the plumeria blossoms, are beyond description. I used to bicycle up to the University of Hawaii, and I would see plumeria blossoms lying on the sidewalk. I'd stop the bicycle and pick up the plumeria blossoms for a closer look, and of course to smell them. I'd never seen anything like them. Sure, we had rose petals on the fence back in the Bronx when I was a kid. They were soft and beautiful in their own way, but this was something unique. The perfumed scent of the plumeria was unlike anything on the mainland. There I am, surrounded by such incredible beauty. The yellow hibiscus, the golden sunsets, the colorful rainforest birds in the back of the valley that I'd never known existed. And before long, I start to get turned into my own body in a way I'd never tuned into my own body in a way I'd never been tuned into. Here's how the Hawaiian transformation works. Even if you've never lived in the tropics, you instinctively start shedding clothing. It's off with the long sleeves, the shoes, and leather. You put it all away, and now you're in flip-flops and shorts. At night, the breeze zips through your sleeves, and you start to become alive in a new way. You're drawn to the ocean. With the migratory seagulls soaring overhead, you start to feel like the original man. In that magical state of mind, you decide to buy a sailboat. I bought the Taranga. Actually, it was the Tarangi, a sloop-rigged sailing vessel about 22 feet long, made primarily of white oak. It had been built in Oregon and sailed out by somebody to Hawaii. I bought it for next to nothing. Although she was in perfect shape, she had no engine. I kept her in the Aliwai Marina and quickly learned most people who own boats mainly use them to drink on and just hang out. Me? I was foolish enough to actually want to sail a boat, even though I knew nothing about sailing. What's more, I decided to take her out without an engine. I figured it would be easy to get out because the wind was prevailing westward out of the harbor. A few of my new friends released the lines, cast me off, and pushed me backward for my maiden voyage. So there I was sailing down the Aliwai Channel and then out into the ocean by myself. I zipped along with the sail wide open, heading further out to sea. I was thinking, this is unreal. I can do anything. It wasn't long before I realized I had miscalculated the situation. Simply put, I didn't know how to get back. Suddenly my mind was racing for answers. You know, how do I turn this thing around if the wind is blowing out to sea? I had no idea, not a clue. The sloop didn't come with an owner's manual. I hadn't paid for lessons. So I'm thinking I had better figure out what to do because at the rate I was going, I'd soon be in the middle of the Pacific Ocean with no way back at all. What's worse, I had no radio, no flares, no engine, and no provisions. I don't think I even had a life preserver. I know that sounds crazy, but remember, I was an inexperienced operator. I didn't know what I didn't know. Besides, the late 60s was an age when many people had total madness about what they could do and accomplish, whether or not it had a basis in reality. I admit all I had was hubris. My first move, I resorted to common sense. I dropped the sails because that, of course, would cut the motion of the boat. With the sails secured, I tried using the tiller to turn the boat around. You know, flip-flop, flip-flop, until I got the boat pointing back toward land. Then I figured if the wind is blowing against me, there must be a way to go into a prevailing wind and still move against it. I had seen other people do it. And little by little, lo and behold, I was able to return to the harbor. I still don't know whether it was pure luck, a strong undercurrent, or God's hand pushing me to safety. I quickly learned that sailing is not for the amateur. Here's the connection to President Obama. America is the boat. Whoever is at the helm determines her destination. If he's experienced, if he's wise, if he understands the fundamentals of boating, then all is well. She'll remain safe and strong, able to sail again for generations to come. If not, apart from a lucky break or God's direct intervention, she'll drift further out into dangerous waters without a prayer or survival. It all comes down to the heart, soul, and experience of the sailor. Does the sailor have a healthy respect for the laws of boating on the high seas, or does he ignore them and do as he pleases, putting himself and the boat in mortal peril? Is he wise enough to recognize the danger signs on the horizon and quickly change course? Or in the face of certain disaster, is he too arrogant and reckless to make the necessary adjustments while there's still time? We're living in dangerous times. Page 3. We have a political novice in America's wheelhouse. Moreover, the president is propelled only by a dangerous hyperdosage of hubris. Is that an overstatement? We all know the former junior senator from Illinois had about a 5-minute political career before campaigning for the highest office in the land. In other words, Obama has no governing experience. He doesn't know how to lead. Worse, he has been indoctrinated by Marxist professors. He's convinced that the failed ideas of Marxism and socialism will suddenly work now that he's in charge of the ship. However, the navigational chart he's relying on to steer the country from capitalism to socialism is fatally flawed. And now he's lost and over his head. Obama has taken a hammer and sickle to our economy, saddling us with a national debt we can never repay. He's exercising ultra-tolerance with Islamic terrorists, rendering America vulnerable. What's more, there's not a scintilla of bipartisan consensus in Congress, as Obama had promised. It's gridlock while the middle class is shell-shocked. Let me put it to you this way. Obama never ran a state before he became the head of state. I'll come back to this from trickle-up poverty, which I think is the most exciting thing you've heard in the political landscape for this last few years, don't you think? I'll be right back. Savage. Radio host banned in UK releases manifesto. Savage unleashed on Grim Reaper Obama, illegals and the nation. Yeah. It is what it is. I can't take back what I wrote, and I can't take back what's in print, and I can't take back that it's in every bookstore in America. I have to live with it. It's as simple as that. We're on the verge of a revolution in this country at the ballot box. And I pray to God that the power structure doesn't try to steal the ballot box, because they'll have a going to be pretty for anybody. I pray to God that these power-mad individuals and these greedy bastards understand that these people are not to be fooled with. And that's why they hate the Tea Party. That's why they hate the Tea Party. They're afraid of them. Because this is the real grassroots movement that they have been trying to manipulate their entire lives. It's what put them in power. They had rent-a-mobs. They ran them all over the country. How do you think they gained this power over us? Rent-a-mobs, fake voting, you name it. All of a sudden, the people are regurgitating. They're throwing it back at them. They don't like it. Do you understand what's going on here? Let me quickly finish the analogy of the sailboat, if I may, the boat. Let me put it to you this way, page 4. Obama never ran a state before he became the head of state, which brings me back to the point of this story. All Barack Obama has is hubris. That said, here's what makes Barack Hussein Obama so dangerous. His hubris is based on nothing more than the failed sugar plum fairy fantasies of Leninism and Marxism dancing around in his head. Since the president has no governing experience, since he has rejected the fundamentals upon which this country has been built, he relies on the fanciful notions of utopia colorfully painted by his communist professors, his Mao-infatuated inner circle of presidential advisors, and his Leninist-loving close personal confidants. This is pretty good writing. You got to admit it, for a right-winger, that man can write. I refuse to sit idly by and allow this man to take America out for a joyride into deep waters. He may be the captain, but I can tell there's a mutiny on board the ship. Just look at how the middle class is taking matters into its own hands. Thousands are speaking up for the first time in town hall meetings. Millions of mothers with strollers are attending local tea parties from coast to coast. Tens of millions more are listening to conservative talk radio. And the invisible pajama army is carving out spots all along the information superhighway, offering fellow travelers news and insight they can find nowhere else. Yes, their class sees the naked reality of what's going down, and they're bracing to fight the enemy within. That's why the Tea Party movement is growing so strong. That's why so many patriots have pinned the flag of American exceptionalism to the mast. No one in his right mind wants to sail headlong into the coming perfect storm. And that's exactly where America's headed, unless we reverse this president, whose roots, as you'll see in the next chapter, are firmly planted in the poisoned soil of Marxism and Leninism. Well, I'll pause right there. And you have to read it yourself. And I'll read it more, I'll read more from the book as the week goes on, with God's will and your listenership. Right now, I'd like to go to the callers on the Savage Nation. WOR in New York is calling. Carolyn, what's going on in New York? What's happening up there in the bookstores?
Well, I want to tell you that I went today to Target, and I found your book. It wasn't hidden, but it wasn't displayed on the front of the aisle like you had said you purchased. Extra to do. It was, and another thing that I wanted to tell you was that on the front of the aisle book, and it, they were about 60.
I don't know who that is. I think he's a guy who uses a ghost writer for him. But did you find the book, my book?
Yes, I did. It was right in the front once you go down the aisle, and the other books that were next to it along the aisle were like 5 and 6 deep. Yours, two books left, and after my purchase, one book left.
All right, so that's a good sign. It means people ran in there and bought it. They're cleaning it out.
I hope so, and I want to tell you that...
Well, here, let me ask you something. Are you going to carry this book around in like anywhere, like to work on a subway? Are you going to take it to... Where are you going to... You know, are you going to hide the book, or are you going to show the cover?
Well, you see, I was thinking about that. I work in the medical profession, and I'm a little bit leery about the reception I'm going to get if I bring the book to work.
Right. But we don't live in America anymore. You have to hide the book. But what if you brought a book by Fidel Castro as a signed by Barack Obama? That you'd be that'd be allowed to be bring to work?
I guess
a book, Mao's Little Red Book, you could bring to work and with no ramifications?
Well, I have to find out if I have the intestinal fortitude that you have.
All right. And you know what? You're right. You're not obligated to put yourself on the line. Let me do it for you. At least you have the book and you can read it in the privacy of your own home. You can hide with it. But I'm telling people that they can use the book cover itself as a walking billboard. And if millions of people, the army, the Savage Nation army, the 8 to 10 million people strong, let us say 500,000 of you buy the book. Let's be realistic. And 500,000 book covers are walking around this country. You've got a billboard that will change the course of human events.
Savage.
Go, go! Go, Johnny, go, go! Go, Johnny, go, go! Go, Johnny, go, go! Go! Johnny, be good!
We still have the greatest country on earth, I gotta tell you that. I mean, you say, well, that's, you know, I've heard it before, what does it really mean? I'll tell you, it means a lot. We have a division in the country that I've never seen in my lifetime. The 60s were bad. I don't know how America actually survived the 60s. with the radicals and what they were doing in this country, it's hard to believe we've actually survived. But fundamentally, they've taken over the country, whether in body or in mind. We're being run by the radicals of the 1960s. Every one of their dreams has been enacted or is attempted to be enacted by Barack Hussein Obama and his gang of czars. I lived through the 60s. I know the hatred for the bourgeoisie. I know their hatred for the military. I know their hatred for the family. I know their hatred for the church. I know their hatred for the flag. Believe me, I've lived through it. And this is not happening by accident. This is a plan. It's by design. Now, having said that, we are still living in a time of peace, internal peace in this country. I was watching a show on TV last night that was astounding. It was one of the most astounding documentaries I've ever seen in my life. And, you know, this is the genius of television. It was a documentary about the son of Pablo Escobar, the former cocaine kingpin of Colombia. I could not believe what I was watching. Here is a man who is about 40 years old now, who was a child. And remember, the son of Pablo Escobar is living in exile in Argentina. And he's telling his whole story of how he lived as a kid. The point of this documentary is that he sends a letter to the grown sons of men who had been assassinated by his father's murderers as they were about to take over Colombia and save it from the drug cartels. Pablo Escobar had them murdered in cold blood, shot to death, killed, you know, butchered. And it showed the kids then and the men that they are now. And the documentary moves forward to Pablo Escobar's son, who actually still is amazing how he looks like him, but he's a pacifist, a total pacifist. And the other boys, these other Colombian guys, are now 40-year-old men, really sweet, beautiful men, and they sit down together at the end of the documentary, and they read the letter that Pablo Escobar's son sent to them, and you hear them talking to each other in the camera, and they say, this is a very, very brave thing that he did. He's asking their forgiveness for killing, for his father having killed their father. Because one of them says, when my father was killed at 8 years of age, I swore vengeance. I swore I would kill those who killed my father. And he said, now I'm a man. He said, time has healed all wounds. But he said, I can see it's not healed his wounds. He's still hurting, so let's meet with him. And they sit down and they have a conversation. I watch something and I learn something. I learned that America is still the greatest country on earth. We have not yet descended to that animalistic third world level. We've not descended to the level of brutality and murder between and against politicians, thank God. We have not yet descended where a voice of opposition can be resented and hated even, but not destroyed. We still live in the greatest country on earth. I pray to God that the desperate people in the Democrat Party recognize what they have, and they don't go to the next step and drag us into the third world level. I'm not sure it won't happen. That's all I can tell you. I'm not sure it won't happen. It's happened in other places, and they are desperate right now. They're real desperate right now. And God only knows what might happen tomorrow. All I can say is I pray to God that we survive Barack Obama. That's all I can say. There's nothing more I can say right now. Now let me go to the callers. Las Vegas calls. Christine, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I've had two experiences with trickle-up poverty, and I've only owned the book for 4 hours. The first experience was with Borders Books around 12:30 in Las Vegas time, and I went in there looking for your book, and I always look in the front because a new book should be up front. So I looked and looked, and it was nowhere to be found. So I asked a lonely little clerk, and she pointed me into the back by the bargain books in the middle of the store. She says, there it is.
Oh, my God.
I proceeded to ask her, well, why is it here, not up front? And she says, well, this is where the manager wanted it to be.
Oh, so wonderful. Okay, here's what I want to know. Christine, the name of the store is Borders in Las Vegas. Where in Las Vegas? Because I'm going to tell you right now, I've asked my publisher, if any manager, any clerk does this to the book, they're going to get fired. They will get fired. They will get fired. They're violating company policy. They don't run that bookstore. They work for the ownership of the bookstore, and it's a business. It's not a hobby. So give me the name of the store again.
It's Borders Books.
Hey, now, tell me the good experience.
Well, I'm not done yet.
No.
So I went to the front of the store, and I saw an empty rack up front, right up front, in front of the front doors. And so I proceeded to pick up the 12 copies of your book, Trickle Up Poverty, and I proceeded and I put them up front. The manager was going to come over to me, and I could see that, you know, I was in trouble because I moved the book. And so I just grabbed my copy and went in line to buy. And as I went into line, I looked for the people that were coming in. It's quite a busy store. Three people came in and asked for your book, and the manager said, "Well, right here it is, my dear." So as I was going out the store, after I bought the book, the manager told the little lonely clerk that I dealt with the first time to go get the extra copies in the back and to bring them up front.
Oh, my God. Okay. So she got frightened that you were an activist and she might get reported and lose her job.
Yeah,
see, you know, wait a minute. You know, there's a moral to this story, Christine. What you just did was brave, number one, and I want to thank you, number two. But in essence, what you did in that bookstore is what's going on at tea parties across America, at town hall meetings. The people are taking charge of their destiny. That's amazing. Are you a member of a local activist group of any kind, Christine?
No, I'm not. But I am a conservative. I am a fifth-generation American. And my great-grandfathers, both of them, fought in the Civil War. And I'm not going to let this country go down without a fight.
And well, you just fought for me. I don't know how to thank you other than to do this, Christine. If you stay on the line, I'm going to send you a free copy, even though you bought one, so you can give it away to a loved one. How's that? Would that work for you? Or give it to a soldier.
Okay.
You know what I want people to do? Buy an extra copy and give it to a man in uniform that you see passing in the street or on an airplane or wherever you are. Would you do that? Would you stay on the line, Christine, because you're going to get it?
Dr.
I'd love to see that. I'd like to see the military get copies of this book for free. I really would. Maybe we can work that out. Steve, well, we got so many wonderful callers around the country. I just want to find out what's going on. I think it's very exciting to me. Jim in New York on WOR, tell me what happened with you today. Go ahead, please.
Well, this story goes back when I was buying your book, Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. I'm in a Barnes & Noble, and the woman in front of the teacher, and she's the clerk is spinning around, excited to give her the teacher discount card, and meanwhile I'm holding your book, and I'm next in line, so they go through their whole exchange, and then I get up there, and she sees me holding your book, and she's, you know, just crestfallen. She's disgusted at what I'm buying, and then I said, "Well, I'm a teacher too. Can I have my discount card?" And I got less of a dramatic presentation of the discount card and all the benefits that went with it. She was kind of just.
All right. So you got disrespected because you didn't buy a book along the lines of the Communist Manifesto. Okay, you bought a book called The American Manifesto, Trickle Up Poverty. I'm going to send you a free copy. Stay on the line. Let's go to another market, please, another city. Let's go to San Diego. Jay, you're on the Savage Nation. Your experience, please.
Dr. Savage, pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Left the I walked in to get your book, and like Christine said, you know, they're supposed to have all the new books up front.
Right.
So I happened to notice that three other individuals were circling the box up front, you know, looking for a book. These individuals happen to be guys my age, 23 years old, younger guys.
Wow.
We're looking around for books, and I think we kind of were looking across at each other because we all had the same thing in mind, but we were too scared to say something. Because on the top were books like Obama Saves, you know, Economy, Obama Stops Crisis, this and that.
All right. Obama Saves World Just in Time, Stop the Presses.
Exactly. So eventually, one of us looks down. Your book was at the very bottom, facing away from the door, where barely anybody could see it. So one person reaches down and grabs the book, and then the rest of us reach down and grab the same exact book. A guy comes up from behind us, an even younger kid, with his hat on backwards, with one of your books, saying, "Hey, I just read two chapters. It's an awesome book."
Amazing. No, I said to somebody the other day that I have a very young demographic. People say, "Oh, conservative talk radio is old. It's only guys over 50 who have impotence and they need hair cream." They don't understand that there's a revolution that's occurred in this country amongst guys your age who are searching for guidance, who want leadership, who are bold but don't have the words yet, And I'm thanking that you, I'm really thankful that you really called me today, because you are kind of in a different league here, Jay. So the three of you actually bought the book.
We all three of us got the book. And I think the biggest thing is that we're all coming out of university, and we have this, you know, liberalism, you know, all these ideas, you know, pounded, you know, crammed down our throats. You know, I'm sure you know what it's like. If you're in a classroom and you go against the teacher, you know, with their extreme liberal views, you know, you don't get an A in the class.
You get a D or you get an F. I've told kids along the way who've told me that went on, I said, don't fight with the teachers or they're going to punish you, because it's no longer a free society. You're living in a controlled pseudo-communist society. And this has been going on primarily from inside the institutions of lower education. And now they've foisted themselves upon the political system. Exactly what went on in the universities for 10 or 15 years has now jumped out of the universities like the disease it is. And this disease of liberalism has now penetrated and permeated not only the media but the political structure. But you're part of the solution, not part of the problem, aren't you?
I hope so. I hope I can be. That would be the best thing that I've
done. Jay, let me ask you something. I'm going to ask you something that a TV personality asked me this morning. If you could pick someone to be president running against Obama in 2012, other than Sarah Palin, who would it be?
I don't know. It doesn't seem that they
want to. See, you don't know, because the Republicans have not produced a real candidate yet. They have not done it. They have nobody on the bench that we know who stood up for us with the Ground Zero Mosque, who stood up for us on so many other issues. They've been invisible, and that's not leadership. Jay, I'm sending you a free copy of TUP to give away to another friend. Save another mind. I'll be right back.
Savage.
So here's an email. Mike, I went to a bookstore in my neighborhood and the clerk said to me, come with me, it's in the bathroom. I expect that tomorrow. New York City, WOR. Jonathan, welcome to the Savage Nation. What did you have happen to you today?
Good evening, Dr. Savage. Currently picking up my mother-in-law at the airport, LaGuardia, and walked into the Borders bookstore and asked the attendant where your book was. At first, she didn't know what the book was. Gave me sort of a snide look, and then decided to take me to the rear of the bookstore.
Uh-huh. Well, there's another case. Was this a Borders Books at LaGuardia Airport?
Yes, sir.
Well, for asking for it and putting up with her, I'm sending you a free copy of TUP that you can give to a service member that you run into. That's what I'm going to... I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Anyone who has bought a book, who calls in and gets on the air from now on, you could do what you want with the free copy. I'd like you to give the free copy away to a serviceman that you pass in the street, just as a gift from me and from you. How's that? It's your gift. Do what you want with it. I think we need to get more of this message out to the military itself. I spoke to a young man who served two tours in Iraq as a machine gunner on a Humvee. He wasn't serving hot meals. And I asked him, he's a young guy, I said, do you happen to know what your mission was? He said, no, nobody knew what the mission was. He said, our mission was to go out and get shot at and shoot back. He said, that was our mission. And he said, many of my friends never came back. He said, that was our mission. I said, when I said today that we should get out of Afghanistan, did you find it offensive as a former member of the military, a combat veteran? He said, no. He said, most members of the military want out of Afghanistan. He said, the wives want them out. The families want them out, because they're rotating them over and over again. Some people have served six tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. Six tours in hell. And that's because we no longer have a draft. We have an all-volunteer army and all-volunteer military, as a matter of fact. And that's why they're being abused. They're being abused by old men who could care less about them, is what many of the people are saying to me. And so I think that the TV people were quite surprised today when they introduced me as Michael Savage, you know, conservative, with a huge radio audience. Where do you stand on the war? And when I said I think we should pull out of Afghanistan because I have no idea why we're there, they were shocked. They were surprised to hear it because they typecast me and they assume that they could figure out what I'm going to say in advance. But they can't figure out what I'm going to say. They have to understand I'm a thoughtful person. I'm also a man who knows history. I've seen nations ruined by wars without end. If you study World War I, and I don't want to get sidetracked right now, It's a war that never should have happened. It started by accident, the assassination of the Archduke of Austro-Hungary. Then one country after another ganged up on the next country. First it was Austria-Hungary against Serbia. Then it was Germany joining this one. Then it was Russia saying we can't let them win. Then it was France saying we can't let them win. Then it was England saying we can't let them win. But mainly it was about the munitions manufacturers. Most of the big militaries at that time had weapons that had not been used. New monster ships called dreadnoughts that were less than 10 years old. Weapons that were phenomenally powerful and destructive called machine guns that had never been used. And believe me, the generals were anxious to try them out on the other person's son. And millions of boys lost their lives. People came back without faces and they were burned to death. Their lungs were shot. For what? Can anyone listening to this show tell me one benefit from World War One? I'll tell you one negative from World War One. That was the development of Adolf Hitler, the advent of Adolf Hitler. That was because Germany lost World War One and was forced to pay reparations by the God darn League of Nations. And as a result of those reparations, the German economy was destroyed. And as a result of that destruction, a right-wing maniac, a racist maniac named Adolf Hitler was able to rise up. And as a result of that, millions of people lost their lives, all going back again to World War One. So as I say to you, war is hell, and war has consequences. And we were in Iraq long enough to recognize that the Arabs are never going to say thank you. We liberated 24 million Shia, and what did we get for it? Did you get so much as a barrel of oil? They gave their first oil contracts to China. Did we see any oil, as George Bush said, we'd get oil as reparations? Where'd that ever go, Mr. Bush? How come the Republicans don't talk about that? Oil as reparations? Whoever paid us back for the Iraq war? Forget the guys who lost their lives or lost their bodies or lost their hearts or lost their minds. What about plain dollars? $1 trillion? $2 trillion? Iraq is oil rich. Why don't we have their oil bounty? You tell me the answer to that. Well, there's many answers to these questions, and I think that you can find them pretty much either on this show or in Trickle Up Poverty. But the point is that I am very thoughtful, and I'm not predictable. One last caller right now in the Savage Nation in Florida. Tom, welcome to the program. What happened to you today?
I had a very good experience in Boynton Beach, Florida, really about an hour and a half after they opened. And the girl was right in front, and the girl at the checkout counter said this thing was flying off the shelf, and she said think of at least 25 books that went out the door.
What was the name of the chain store? What was the chain job? Well, I'm going to still send you a free copy, Tom. Give it to anyone you know or to a service member in uniform because I want to get the message out. You know, that's a great, great audience of mine down from WFTL in Fort Lauderdale. It's a powerful audience, and they love me, and I love them. I've been on that station for a very long time. I hope that we have a relationship for a very long time to come. As you know, I go down there once in a while, and I really do enjoy the area. Well, thus far today, we've had an incredible time talking about the book. I hope that I haven't bored you in some way, but you've got to forgive me my excitement. This is a rejuvenation for me. I've come a long way to this day, and without your help, I'd be nowhere. The truth is, you are everything to me. This is a connection that I can't replace. There's nothing else I can say other than Teddy says, don't roll over for Obama. Or Teddy says, don't let America go to the dogs. This is Michael Savage. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
I did a 12-city tour today inside of one city. You know, it's an amazing thing, the technology. I was promoting my new book, Trickle Up Poverty. I can't believe I started in, TV station, Wichita, Kansas, Rochester, New York, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Fort Myers, Florida, Detroit, Tucson, San Diego, Cincinnati, Las Vegas, and Phoenix, all in a few hours. It's pretty amazing. I heard that Jimmy Carter did a satellite tour as well for his recent book, but they ran out of strychnine, so he had to cancel it in midstream. I heard that, I heard that Barbara Boxer did a satellite tour recently, but she canceled after four cities because they ran out of bagels. It's absolutely true. I heard from the inside that there was a tour, and Sean Hannity was going to do a tour, but they ran out of nails, and he refused to continue on the tour because he got a hammer and he didn't know what to do with it. But in all seriousness, it was quite an experience. Teddy and I did it, and I think it's the last I'll do because, boy, oh, boy, it's quite stressful. Trickle Up Poverty was a big hit, and it's funny how, you know, since these were mid-American markets, you know, I stuck to two main themes. I really did. One was the astonishing fact that in only 19 months, the president has raised the national debt more so than all presidents combined from George Washington through Ronald Reagan. I then said I have, you know, solutions, including putting tariffs on Chinese goods so that we can rebuild America's manufacturing base by leveling the playing field. And I think both of those facts resonated with America. I'm pretty sure they did. I didn't get into many more details. I did talk about the war. I said maybe you expect me as a conservative to say gung-ho, go fight it. But I know too many military men who are saying they don't know why they're there. You know that some men have had six tours of duty? In Vietnam, it was one tour, and then you were out. If you didn't die, you came home. There are guys being sent back every other year. They're using them like cannon fodder. It's an outrage. And I say, since they don't even know who the enemy is, they won't define it. In the book, I do say it. I said it. End the war, period. Bring the boys home now. So it was quite an interesting experience for me, the satellite tour. Teddy came along. He sat at my feet the whole time. When the sound man came to adjust the earphone, he went for his feet and hands. And my assistant had to grab Teddy. No, every time he adjusted the earpiece, Teddy was right on his shoes. So I didn't put Teddy on the screen, except toward the end, one city. The man in San Diego is a big listener of the show down there on the radio, and he said, do you have Teddy in the studio? I said, I do. He said, can we see him? Or something like that. Teddy did make a brief appearance in San Diego today, and I picked up his paw, and I said, Teddy says, don't roll over for Obama. Well, the host laughed. He got a kick out of it. The fact is, I did get an immediate letter from the American Dog Association, and they want to bring me up on dog labor charges. We're going to have to see if we can fight that one out of court. Remember, I coined the phrase Michael Savage News, Views, and Reviews. I do the news, I give you my views, and sometimes I give you reviews. And I want to be positive now, because sometimes I lay awake at night and I say, you know, I can be very negative, but that's not enough. How about being positive on something? So I'll tell you what. I'm going to tell you about a movie I saw by accident that was so good I ordered a DVD. And I didn't even know who had directed it until after I watched it, thank God, because if I had known that they were the directors, I probably wouldn't have watched it. You know what I'm saying? It was strange. It appeared on like a Showtime scanner. You know, you look at what's going on. I already forgot the name of it. A Special Man. Do you remember the name of it, Beowulf? You just ordered a movie from me. Search your notes. I forgot already the name. Joel and Ethan Coen did the movie in 2009. So they did No Country for Old Men, which, you know, is a mixed bag. You know, either you like their shtick or not, but A Serious Man. Okay. So I see the lineup for it. I'm scanning for a movie, and it says a college professor, has a series of problems and this and that, and his wife's going to leave him. She's having an affair with his best friend, and his neighbor sunbathes nude, you know, nude, blah, blah, blah. So I mean, I'll watch it. It seemed like an oddball thing, and it caught me off guard because the character who plays the physics professor at a small Midwestern college was deadpan. He was phenomenal. I forget his name. And it's set in Milwaukee, Minneapolis, I think 1960s, in a tract house. So this physics professor lives with his wife and two children. The daughter is stealing money from him to buy some, to get a nose job. And the son is secretly smoking pot in order to get through his bar mitzvah lessons. And it's like a religious Jewish family, but not really religious. And he lives in a neighborhood of not, you know, not all Jewish people, obviously. And it's this bland suburban scene. And it keeps growing and growing. It's awesome. The movie was awesome. I don't know how to describe it any more than I did. I mean, I'm recommending it very highly. And at the end, I was shocked when I read the credits. It was Joel and Ethan Coen. Within a year that they won the Academy Award, they were able to do this as their work of love. You know what I'm saying? It was amazing. A serious man. I highly recommend it.
Savage.
The Obama administration and the government media complex, they refuse to fix the problems at the border. They're running on national debt higher and higher at a phenomenally high rate. And they refuse to even name our enemy because it would not be politically correct or sensitive to those who want to destroy us. But they really don't have any problem when they lash out at the Tea Parties. They call them hate mongers and racists. Can you imagine that? Joining us now to talk about this classic double standard is columnist Jack Hunter.
Good to be with you today, Michael. You know, the establishment media has been having a good time beating up on Christine O'Donnell, the Republican Delaware Senate nominee for that race there in Delaware, a Tea Party candidate, if you will. On Bill Maher's program, the liberal comedian, O'Donnell said about a decade ago that she believed evolution is a myth. Now, millions of Christians, I think, would agree with O'Donnell, and I'm not here today to talk about whether evolution is true or not, only to point out that the same sort of religious fundamentalism that the left and the establishment media are beating up on O'Donnell about, they are also guilty of on a even much grander and more dangerous scale.
Why do you say that?
Well, let's just go through the list of recent history. It's so easy to look at the government fundamentalists who run things up there in Washington, D.C., and their own blindness to anything outside their faith in big government. Let's look at TARP. When George W. Bush said, you know, we have to intervene in the free market to save the free market, we heard from both left and right, Democrat and Republican, that TARP has to happen right now. It has to happen immediately, or everything's going to collapse and the economy will be much worse. And what did we see happen? Well, the economy not only did not get better, it got worse, and we were told, well, these things take time. To this day, you will talk to establishment Republicans who defend the necessity of TARP. Of course, the left defends the necessity of TARP, even though if you do it by the numbers, you crunch the numbers, it was not a success. It was a transfer of wealth to the fat cats on Wall Street, as you point out in your new book, Trickle Up Poverty. You touch on this. It was a transfer of wealth to those people from the taxpayers, and yet you can't get people in government to see anything outside their government fundamentalist belief in TARP. Let's go on to other issues.
Well, like what?
Let's look at Barack Obama's nearly $800 billion stimulus plan. To this day, the Democrats defend this plan. They say it was absolutely necessary. I believe Barack Obama told us that it was intended to create jobs, and yet there hasn't been a dent in unemployment numbers. Do you remember President Obama saying that with this $800 billion package, it would make its way to, quote, shovel-ready infrastructure projects? Well, none of that has happened. Not even a third of money has gone to the projects that Obama once touted. The Chicago Tribune's Steve Chapman, a columnist, had this to say about it. Quote, as a way of expanding the economy, it's a proven failure. But as a way of expanding government, it's definitely a keeper. Now, Chapman is on to something there. These government fundamentalists, Barack Obama and the Democrats, to this day, sing the praises of the stimulus. It was absolutely necessary, much like TARP. And we have to do it now, the immediacy. Well, experts from across the board, economists, politicos, have recognized its failure, and yet the Democrats can't see anything outside of it, just like they accuse Christine O'Donnell with her evolution comments, that she just is blind to the facts. Well, our government fundamentalists are blind to the facts.
But Obama said a short while back that the economic downturn was over.
Well, not only is that absolutely absurd, and to go into another area of government fundamentalism, which is what informed TARP and the stimulus, it's sort of this Keynesian economic thinking. If increased deficit spending, and this is what these people believe, that increased deficit spending is what stimulates the economy, then why are not, oh, I don't know, Italy, France, and Germany superior world economic powers? How about a nation like Greece? We see what's happening in Europe and what's going to start happening here in the United States if we keep spending money the way we do. And that's just another example of government fundamentalism.
Well, but the media tells us how great the European model is working. I didn't ever want to live in Greece personally.
That's exactly right, and it shows you just how blind they are to the facts at hand. Look at an economist like Paul Krugman, a liberal economist, writes for the New York Times. Here's a guy who should be Obama's preacher in his church of big government, if you will, because this guy believes not only was Obama right and using the stimulus and the European model is a good idea and implementing it, but his problem with it is it wasn't big enough. Paul Krugman, and I'm not joking, argues that we need a bigger, more monstrous stimulus than the $800 billion that Obama did.
No.
Lesson not learned, but what it gives these government fundamentalists the sort of luxury of saying is when it doesn't work, well, we didn't do enough. If it ever does work, well, look, isn't this great and big government is the way to go? And, of course, it doesn't work, as all the experts point out, which is what I'm getting at. These people laughing at Christine O'Donnell about her evolution comments, or Tea Party, or saying they're sort of narrow-minded and religious fundamentalists and can't see outside their own faith. It's just as bad with these big government types in Washington, D.C., and they're being completely hypocritical in their accusations and criticism. Well, let's switch from economics for a moment, Michael, and get into another favorite subject of yours and mine when it comes to these government fundamentalists and not being able to see the forest for the trees, border security. You know, I know, most Americans know that our borders are practically wide open. We have no serious clampdown on our borders. Illegal immigrations run rampant, 12 to 20 million illegal aliens by some estimates. The situation with Arizona and Jan Brewer fighting the federal government, just trying to do the job the federal government won't do by cracking down on illegal immigration. When you listen to government officials, people like Homeland Security Department head Janet Napolitano says that our borders are more secure than they've ever been in this nation's history. Who does this woman think she's fooling? I think that's just as wrong-headed, depending on your perspective, if you're an establishment type, as Christine O'Donnell saying evolution is a myth. If you see what I'm getting at, certainly Christine O'Donnell's statement is no less ridiculous than what Janet Napolitano is saying. We don't have secure borders. For her to say that is completely ludicrous.
Not to Big Sis. She worships at the government of Big Gov.
It is a religion. Big government is their religion. Their fundamentalist belief in the power of the state, and it's always right, and it's always good, and even when it's not living up to its promises, like with border security, they just pretend that it is. They create their own mythology, if you will.
There is no action on the border issue from Obama. It's not part of his agenda.
Well, that's exactly right, Michael. The borders are completely open. The situation in Arizona is a reaction to their lack of action. And the fact that they can't see it is the point I'm trying to stress today. If we're talking about TARP spending, if we're talking about stimulus, if we're talking about borders, people in our government, the establishment of both parties, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, the highest off in the land, the President of the United States, all have their own narrative about the way things should be and the way things are going in this country. We need to spend more money to stimulate the economy. It doesn't work? Well, I don't want to hear about it. We need TARP to save the banks and save the economy. It doesn't work? I don't want to hear about it. We have open borders. You're complaining, America. Most Americans want something done about the borders. They don't want to hear about it. Across the board, they are not. They do not want to hear the facts that the rest of us recognize on a regular basis, just like the accused Christine O'Donnell of doing with her view on evolution. And if they would just look in the mirror for a moment, they would see the own hypocrisy looking right back at them.
Well, what are the chances of that happening?
The chances are slim to none, because that is sort of a characteristic of hypocrites, and it's also a characteristic of fundamentalists. They can't see anything outside their own narrative. Let's talk about one more issue for a second, and the right and left sort of guilty of this. When Michael Steele, the Republican National Committee chairman, recently said that Barack Obama was being foolish and waging a land war in Afghanistan, sort of that's where empires go to die, Alexander the Great and all the rest. You made the point after Obama announced troop escalation in Afghanistan. What's the end game? What's the exit strategy? Is he making many of the mistakes Bush did, in a sense, that a lot of Americans have a problem with? Well, there's many people on the left questioning this. There's people on the right questioning this. Guys like Tom Coburn, Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, is questioning what we're doing over there. But Obama and the Democrats, their party, that's Obama's war now, can't see outside their own narrative, their own fundamentalism. We must stay. There's no exit strategy. We don't know what we're doing. McChrystal's complaining. Get rid of him. Put Petraeus in there. Petraeus can't even tell you the end game. What are we doing? It is a belief in the faith of government to do things overseas we know it couldn't do at home, and it is another form of big government fundamentalism. I'm sorry.
Are there any signs that things are going to get better?
Well, the only hope is to defeat these people. I mean, I don't think anybody on the left who now criticizes Christine O'Donnell thinks sort of they can make alliances with religious fundamentalists. Well, that works both ways. It is up to us as grassroots conservatives, members of the Tea Party, who are sort of seeing straight on what needs to be done economically, seeing straight on what needs to be done with our borders, are willing to consider what Michael Steele said about Afghanistan. Across the board, just seeing a more realistic common sense approach to things, we need to defeat these people, whether in November here in 2010, 2012, and beyond. It's good when it looks like Sharon Angle is up in the polls above Harry Reid. That's a wonderful thing. When guys like Rand Paul are going to defeat the Democrat there, and Jack Conway in Kentucky, Joe Miller up there in Alaska, Christine O'Donnell, quite frankly. We need real people, Tea Party candidates, genuine grassroots conservatives who can defeat these big government fundamentalists, and that's what it's all going to boil down to.
Well, thanks for the report, Jack.
Well, Michael, I'm looking forward to reading your book. Can't wait to get my hands on it today. A little bit of what I talked about here today is in the book. And as always, I encourage your listeners to visit SouthernAvenger.com. And as always, thanks for having me. Y'all take care.
The left wing refuses to protect our borders, our language, and our culture. This is the reason that I wrote Trickle Up Poverty. This is our chance to stop Obama's attack on our borders, economy, and security.
Savage.
So it's been quite a day, quite a demanding day at that. Now, I've given you the 10, 11, 12 cities I was in. But let me give you this. Borders, economy, security, right? What does that mean? Now, so many books out there don't have a plan. Why should you buy a book that just complains? I don't know. How about a book that has solutions? I have solutions. I have pages, 37 solutions. And I think that they're a litmus test for people running for office. You want to hear them? Well, I think I've given them to you. I mean, I pointed out a number of problems in the book, and I can give you the solutions. English only. Make English the official language of the U.S. Close the borders. Defend the borders. Repeal and defund Obamacare. Reduce the size and scope of government. Liquidate TARP. Strike down the Anchor Babies Law. Deport jailed illegal aliens. Fire Janet Napolitano. Use profiling to prevent terror attacks. How would that work for you? Rewrite the rules of engagement. Reinforce the military infrastructure by granting a pay raise to our combat veterans. Silence the Hitler of Iran. Allow no more hate speech rants on U.S. soil from the Hitler of Iran. Deny this junior dictator permission to enter our country and to attack us. Meanwhile, ship to Israel the necessary munitions, including bunker buster bombs, that will enable them to mount a military strike on Iran's nukes if necessary. The biggest one, really, was imposed tariffs on China. And I'm going to talk more about that over the days to come. Offer health savings plans. Institute a flat tax. Keep the estate tax at zero. Shall I go on? Say no to the VAT tax. Reduce pay and pensions for civil servants. Why is New York City paying a $242,000 tax-free disability pension per year for a former fire chief? Why do almost 2,000 House of Representatives staffers take down six-figure incomes? Did you hear that? How can 43 staffers for the House of Representatives soak the public for $172,000? This is an outrage and must be cut to reflect current economic realities. Make abortions illegal, with the exception of the physical survival of the mother. End affirmative action. Limit welfare benefits. Boot the czars. Put the brakes on GM. reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. Well, that's about controlling Wall Street. And then finally, institute tort reform, meaning control the lawyers. 37, run the country like a business, not an empire. It's commonsensical, which means it's not nonsensical, which means that the politicians are running scared from it. All of this and more in the book, Trickle Up Poverty. And I say no longer can we be Barack Obama sheeple and let the American dream be trampled, beaten, and burned to the ground. Okay? Does that work for you? How about ignoring the Tea Party, which is the real voice of the people? This is no longer a representative government. Obama is blatantly disregarding and even suppressing the fastest-growing collective voice of the nation, that of the Patriotic Tea Party. His union crony purple shirts have shown up at town hall meetings and a peaceful protest to intimidate and antagonize the democratic process. I am telling you, we are dangerously close to losing the nation we love, but it really isn't too late. If you buy only one book to learn and react to what Obama the Destroyer has done and plans on doing to America, it's my book, Trickle Up Poverty. And that's it. I stand by those words. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. We'll keep talking about this and other topics on the show today, but let's stop for a minute. I know you listen because this is one of the last places you can get real, honest, independent, conservative opinions and unfiltered news. And I want you to get the full impact of the Savage Nation. Go to TRN1.com, become a premium member, and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcast at TRN1.com. Click on my picture at TRN1.com today. So let's go to the calls now around America. Thanks for listening. Robert, New York, WOR. Go ahead, you're on the air. What's on your mind, Robert?
A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about what type of artist I thought you were. And I said an expressionist, a realist. And given thought up in the Adirondacks for a week, I think that really you are a verbal Dadaist.
Dada, mama. What do you mean Dadaist?
Well, Dadaist, in fact, just like the story of the Italian deli, or a story you once told about being in the line at a Starbucks, where you can just take a commonplace event and turn it into art in your story.
Well, okay, but I understand that. But when Van Gogh painted the potato eaters, that didn't make him a Dadaist, did it?
No, the Dadaists were more tongue-in-cheek.
Ah.
Right? Marcel Duchamp, Man Ray, you know, taking the urinal, E. Mont, writing a name on it, hanging it on the wall.
Okay, I get it. Yeah, when I get into Man in the Street stuff, I could see it's all crazy out there. In other words, it is like the ticket that exploded. It's like William Burroughs, the ticket that exploded. The whole world is like the ticket that exploded, isn't it?
Well, I think William Burroughs is a good point. You know, yes, it's the Beats more than the hippies.
Well, now we're already bordering on a dangerous terrain because I knew some of the Beats. They were the most terrible people I ever met on the planet. None of them were straight up. None of them were any good. All right, but you're saying it's like me. You know, when I went out the other night with a couple of good people, I said to them, I don't even care what a person's politics are. If they entertain me, I'll watch their movie. I actually take that back. The other night I was sitting and watching some movie. I was passing, and it was Robert De Niro. I usually like anything he does, even though he's a lefty. I don't care. But there was a scene where Sean Penn appeared in it. I got nauseous and turned it off. I won't even watch anything with Sean Penn in it anymore. He's such an America hater. I can't watch the man.
Well, I can understand why.
See, so now I'm going from Dadaist to realist, right?
Well, Dadaist, yes, to realist.
So what do you do up in the Adirondacks? What kind of art?
I'm a painter. You know, we talked about, I do sort of abstract work.
Let me get into, like, imagine. I don't know you. So you're up there. You got a house near the lake. You got pine cones, a screened-in porch, or what?
Cabin, little cabin on the lake, right? My wife go up there, and we write. We write a newsletter, part of it around the country.
But what do you do, like, when you get bored? I mean, you don't go anywhere? I mean, there's nothing, like, you can't even get a coffee in there.
I don't get bored. I always have something.
You're a very lucky man, because I've thought about, you know, the rustic life. Even from the time I was young, I always thought I'd end up in the Adirondacks, strangely enough. You know, originally, I didn't want that much out of life. I thought I would teach high school. I'd retire. I would have a little house on a lake. I used to love the lakes up there. You know what it is? What ruined me is the years I spent in the South Pacific Islands alone collecting plants. I couldn't take the After that, isolation became my enemy. Now, it doesn't mean that I cannot take solitude. Solitude is different than isolation, Robert. Am I correct about that?
Yes. Yes.
You see, people don't understand the difference between the nuances between solitude and isolation. Solitude is one thing. I like to work alone. I like to do my show alone. But isolation is another story. When you get into an isolated location, as I was on islands, all alone, hardly speaking the Fijian language, as nice as the Fijians were, I felt as though I had landed on the moon and I was trying to communicate with another species of people. I was strange to them, they were strange to me, and as beautiful as they were, it was very, very alienating, frankly.
I couldn't live in the Adirondacks all year long.
Oh, now you're going to say you have a private jet and you fly to Aruba whenever you want.
No, I get in my car and drive back down to Beacon, New York, you know. I mean, but it's...
All right,
it's,
well, to each his own. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. San Diego, Danny, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Dr. Savage, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I just wanted to address your fish comment. As a young boy, I used to fish in Connecticut. I'm originally from Connecticut, and we would fish in a lake called Lake Saltonstall, and we would catch freshwater bass. And after we would catch the bass, we would cut the bass up, and we would, you know, take the insides out and cook the bass up immediately. And the smell of the bass, when you took it out and you cut it up, did not smell anything like the fish you would buy at a supermarket or anything. It would smell like nature. It smelled tremendous, and it tasted completely different. And now I'm in L.A., and I can't get really anything like that unless I go fishing again. It's just amazing the difference.
Well, no, but I was saying as I go to a certain fish market where the guy gets it literally that day from a fishing boat in Monterey, and it smells like that. You know, you still can buy fresh fish from certain purveyors.
Correct. Yeah, that's.
But, you know, when you go to a restaurant, I have a friend who was once a Sicilian guy, used to be a fisherman. He told me most fish today, even if it's fresh, is at least 2 days old. There's no way to go from a boat to a restaurant in less than 2 days, unless the restaurant is right off the dock. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And I, you know, just brought back memories of me fishing and then slicing the fish up, cooking it right up, beating it. And the huge.
That's right. Well, that's right. It was supposed to have memories, good memories. We all need good memories. I'll be right back.
Savage.
The would-be Times Square bomber, Faisal Shahzad, has been sentenced. Listen to this report.
The Times Square bomber who tried to pull off a bombing, he wanted to take down at least 40 people in Times Square, now sentenced to life. This sentence just crossing the wires moments ago. He brought a Pathfinder to Times Square, New York City, loaded it up with ammonium nitrate, 250 pounds, with the intent to kill, now sentenced to life in prison for the Times Square plot.
Okay, continue.
He has been sentenced, Faisal Shahzad, to life behind bars. He told the judge that the defeat of the United States is imminent. Those now
Wait,
his words,
stop.
Most likely the last...
Did you hear that? Another radical Muslim spewing hatred about the defeat of America.
The U.S. Justice Department, in asking for life sentences, submitted to the court two pieces of evidence. One, a propaganda video that he recorded boasting of how easy it was to launch an attack in the United States. And secondly, a reenactment, if you will, that the FBI conducted this summer, putting together a bomb similar to the dud that Faisal Shahzad wanted to set off in Times Square. This bomb, however, did go off as expected on this tape, and it demonstrated to the court the power of the blast.
Thank God the FBI demonstrated what the bomb could have done.
The attack in Times Square would most certainly have been lethal.
And yet not once in this report do they mention radical Islam. Now here's Walter Mondale and Obama.
I think he's very bright.
Note that. Intelligent.
Matter of fact, brilliant.
And certainly not brilliant.
And I think he tends to, and he uses these idiot boards.
Let's repeat that.
Idiot boards.
Idiot boards.
Idiot boards.
Idiot boards. Idiot boards. Idiot boards. Now, here's the conclusion to the sad story of Dr. William Pettit's family's brutal murder, the home invasion case in Connecticut.
We really thank the jury for their due diligence and careful consideration of the charges in reaching what we feel is an appropriate verdict. And we hope they will continue to use the same diligence and clarity of thought as they consider arguments in the penalty phase of the trial.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what matters to me most is my family and my memories of my family and trying to do good things through our...
You may have to wait, but right...
Foundation. I don't know, over the last couple of weeks... I've
comes to those who are
kept
wrong.
Kept trying to tell myself that...
God will see to that.
Good will overcome evil, and we'll keep trying to do good things and try to refocus myself on the positive and stay away from the negative.
Look, I know you worry about what's going on in Afghanistan and what's going on in the White House, but with all of that, you shouldn't have to worry about your computer on top of everything else. So go visit my advertisers at carbonite.com. They'll back up all your important files so they're safe no matter what happens. Use my offer code SAVAGE and you're going to get 2 months free with your subscription. That's carbonite.com, offer code SAVAGE. Anyway, here we are. Here we are. We've had some interesting dialogue thus far today. I'd like to ask you a few questions. You ready for them? Such as, did you go to a bookstore today to purchase the book? And what was the worst thing you experienced trying to buy Trickle Up Poverty? Was the book displayed on the front of counter as it was supposed to be? Was the clerk friendly or belligerent when they noticed which book you were buying? Who did you buy the book for? Did you get any reaction from other people who saw what book you had? How many other people, if any, did you see buying or looking at Trickle Up Poverty? And what type of people seem to be buying the book? How much have you read so far, and is there anything in it that you'd like to read on the air on the Savage Nation? If so, the phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Now, how many times have I told you that you take a vicious street fighter, I don't care who the martial artist is, he's going to kill him. You get into a street altercation without the suits and the outfit and the breaking the bricks. And you get in the position. By the time you get in position, they cut your throat already. How many times have I told you to stop with the training? Do it for your health and do it for the sport, but don't assume you're going to be able to beat a guy who was in jail for 5 years for murder. Did you read this story? Martial arts instructor, it's a very sad story, was stabbed to death in New York by an ex-con while walking his dog. 2 a.m., Brooklyn, New York. Chai Wan Hillman, he was born in Korea, 41 years old. He has a dog. He's in a bar listening to music. And the other guy is there, the stabber, named Daniel Pagan. Both have girlfriends, and their two dogs get entangled. They're like little dogs. They get entangled under the bar. They try to untangle the leashes. And accidentally, the Korean guy, the martial artist who had a karate studio for years, black belt, he accidentally brushes the lunatic's girlfriend. You know, you're getting a dog's leash, brushes. So naturally, the lunatic already goes ballistic and says, "You touched my girlfriend." I've met guys like that, haven't you? It's a pretext to kill somebody. They go outside. The bartender tries to break it up. He stabs the bartender. And then he stabs the martial artist five times, six times, and kills him. Mr. Pagan, Daniel Pagan, who was released from prison in 2000 after serving 9 years for manslaughter, who whipped out the knife and stabbed the martial artist and killed him, has not yet been charged by Mayor Bloomberg's PC police. The Korean-born victim used to run the Chai Karate Martial Arts School in Ardsley, New York. And ironically, in a 1996 interview with the New York Times, Hillman, a black belt, said, "People should study martial arts for self-defense." He said, quote, "They won't be victims. They can choose whether to continue confrontation or get out of it and flee." How many times have I told you that many people are deluded if they think that their martial art training is going to be a cure-all for a street brawl? I'm telling you that a street fighter is more vicious and faster than you are, usually. And if he means to do you harm, he's probably going to get the best of you. Whoever attacks first wins. That's generally true. It's not 100% true. I mean, I watch enough of these extreme fighters to see guys who are so murderously tough. It's hard to believe that they can be on the same planet as I am. But even they, trained fighters that they are, if they confront or are confronted by or get into an argument with a stranger in a bar, and the stranger is a convicted murderer who survived 8 years in a prison to top it all off, I'd bet on the murderer, the guy who's out of prison, you know, for stabbing. That doesn't mean give up martial arts. I'm saying be realistic and don't, you know, how many, I see these girls in these Tai Chi studios, hey, ho, hey, with their suits, they come out, feel, you know, girls fly. Then they think they could fly the 747 or the 767, rather, that you're flying on. Hey, hey, ho, ho. They got the uniform and a belt on them right away. They can beat a murderer. They're training. Hee, hi. Crazy. The whole thing's crazy.
Let's hear some music.
It's rock and roll every day on the Savage Nation.
Are you my lover? I was wrong to try.
I love being with you. I love talking with you. I love talk radio. I love the business that I'm in. I love the fact that we're the last link between you and the abyss. If it wasn't for talk radio and the internet, we would be in the abyss of communism.
Set.